Onichi, I'll be similar. Welcome to African Sky, a podcast sharing the music and arts, culture, and stories of community development of Mali, West Africa. African Sky is an all-volunteer 501c3 organization devoted to building friendship and understanding between the people of Mali and the United States. Find us at africansky.org. African Sky. Spread love. In this episode, we speak with Mina Gurgis, the co-founder, producer, and CEO of The Nile Project. The Nile Project inspires, educates, and empowers Nile citizens to work together to foster the sustainability of their river's ecosystem. The Nile Project works in three program areas: music, university fellowship and campus groups, and a network of scholars and policymakers working on collaborative and sustainable solutions to conflict and poverty issues in the Nile River Basin. What has been called one of the tightest cross-cultural collaborations in history, the Nile Project's musical collective brings together artists from the 11 Nile countries, representing over 400 million people, to make new music that combines the rich diversity of one of the oldest places on Earth. Using music to spark cultural curiosity, the Nile Project engages musicians and audiences, encouraging them to feel connected to the world's longest river and to explore new approaches to its large-scale social, cultural, and environmental problems. NPR called the Nile Project's debut album Aswan one of the five must-hear international albums of 2013. John Perellis of the New York Times said, "To a traditionalist, the Nile Project might look like an ungainly melange, a gathering of musicians from the 11 countries of the Nile Basin playing instruments that weren't made to share a stage or a song. They included an Egyptian wooden flute, an oud, African harps, a thumb piano, a saxophone. The Nile Project was a committed, euphoric international coalition." This episode was recorded in early 2017, when the Nile Project was doing a series of concerts in the United States and recording a live album from those concerts. We met up with Mina in Atlanta. Mina is an ethnomusicologist. He explores new ways to cultivate environments conducive to learning, making, and experiencing music. He specializes in curating and producing innovative musical collaborations across diverse styles. He founded the World Music School Zambaleta in the Bay Area, San Francisco, California. He's from Cairo, Egypt, and now splits his time between the Bay Area and Cairo. So, Mina Gurgis, welcome to the African Sky podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. When you guys came up with the idea, I understand that you went on a scouting trip to the Nile Basin countries in 2012 to find the musicians, to audition them. So how did you find these musicians? Where were they? What was that trip like? And I imagine there's been some turnover. Some musicians are involved in some albums and maybe not other albums. Is that just because of life situations and whatnot? Or is there an intention to have some kind of a sort of revolving door aspect to it?
So the way that we have structured this from the very beginning was as a collective. Collective with a capital C. So it's a collective of musicians from the 11 countries in the Nile Basin. And every year, we invite a certain number of people to participate in the gathering. So these musicians, once they participate in the gathering, they become part of the collective. They understand the creative process of the Nile Project, and then they can participate in any years thereafter. The musicians we have this year, some of them were with us in 2013, some were 2014, some were 2015, and they come and go. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that we leave them behind. It's really kind of, you know, a collection of musicians that have the same values and that bring different voices to what we're trying to do. I would say the scout trip was more about learning what the Nile means to the different countries where we went, rather than select the specific musicians. We met a number of musicians that then joined us in the collective, but many of the musicians that have joined the Nile Project were not the result of meetings in the scout trip.
Okay, How did they end up? They just heard about it and connected?
We have an annual audition, and we also ask people for recommendations, and many of them tell us, you know, I know this person who plays this instrument that would be really good for what you're doing.
Very nice. Tell us, what was your journey that led you to co-found the Nile Project?
Well, I'm from Cairo, Egypt, and I think that has a lot to do with it. I have come to the U.S. for my undergraduate studies here in the Southeast in Florida State University in Tallahassee, and I studied both hospitality and ethnomusicology. I was always interested in the marriage of both, which is kind of an unusual intersection. How do you help build a sense of community through hospitality that encourages musical learning and musical development, and how that musical experience in turn feeds into that sense of community as well and creates a more hospitable environment for everyone. So my work in ethnomusicology has been primarily looking at transboundary musical projects, stories that cross different parts of the world and tell people about connections that you wouldn't normally see. My master thesis was about the music of the gypsies and their migration from India into Europe and the Middle East, and the way the story was, and the way the story was told in the world music industry, and the problematics of telling that story, how people exoticized gypsies further because they learned that they come from India. I also was a fellow at the Smithsonian during the Silk Road Festival in 2002, which was in part an inspiration for the Nile Project. How do you bring together these musicians from different parts of the world and allow them to collaborate to tell a story that encourages dialogue, encourages a sense of cross-cultural empathy, and to work out many of the, I guess, 21st century problems that we're dealing with, whether they happen to be east-west or upstream, downstream.
Your co-founder of the project is Mikleet Hadero, Ethiopian-American singer-songwriter. So tell me a bit about how you guys met and connected in such a way to develop this idea.
Well, Mikleet and I have known each other for a number of years. We both were working at local music organizations in the Mission District in San Francisco prior to the Nile Project. The Nile Project story started around 2011. There was a revolution in Egypt. From there, I was excited by what was happening there, and I went there for the summer. And I started asking myself, you know, I'm an applied ethnomusicologist. I have a connection to this country, to the hopes that people are expressing in the streets. And I want to do something that has to do with this new kind of Egypt, this vision that I see and that we've waited many years to see. But I couldn't really figure out what is of relevance for an ethnomusicologist in a revolution. I went back to San Francisco that summer, and a friend of mine invited me to an Ethiopian concert. Debo Band from Boston was playing in Oakland. I ran into Mikleet there, and that night is when I started thinking about the relevance of this Nile connection between Ethiopia and Egypt. I grew up in Egypt. I had started a world music school in San Francisco, and I was witnessing how learning the music of another culture was changing the way different people saw the world in my music school. And here I was listening to this Ethiopian music that I'd never heard in Egypt, and I wondered how much of an impact that would have if Ethiopian music was available to Egyptians or Egyptian music was available to Ethiopians. They are river neighbors. They don't share a border, so they don't really think of themselves as neighbors. But when you look at the water conflict that was growing in the Nile Basin between Ethiopia to the south, building the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa, and Egypt that gets 85% of its water from the Blue Nile, we knew that there was going to be a flashpoint at some point in the future, and music in a sense can help build the trust and the goodwill that you need to strengthen the social fabric of these populations before that flashpoint. Once people start arguing over water, it's hard to go back. But before that happens, you can definitely use music to strengthen the social fabric.
So you have a 5-step process for your organization's work. Talk us through these 5 processes and what influenced you to develop this kind of process to do the NOAA project work.
Well, the process that we have is inspired by the work of a professor at MIT who's developed something called the U process. And the U process was developed mainly to bring together people from different professional backgrounds to solve a problem that requires all of their inputs, urban planning problems, or, you know, problems that, you know, you need an architect and a policymaker, an economist and a politician to come together and say, okay, we can't do this, we can't do that. So where is that creative space that satisfies all of our priorities and allows us to all walk away with a win-win solution? So we took that idea and we translated it into music. This process happens by first allowing all of these different participants to share their perspectives, share what are their limitations, whether they happen to come from a musical tradition or from a specific discipline. You know, architects have zoning limitations and economists have financial limitations. So you need to kind of like marry these two to find that sweet spot. In the same way, Ethiopian musicians have a pentatonic musical system and Egyptians have a modal system with lots of microtones. So how do you marry these two to come up with something that sounds Ethiopian to the Ethiopians and Egyptian to the Egyptians, and everyone feels like they're making good music? So we start with musical speed dating. We pair our musicians for an hour, and if you have 12 musicians in the room, then you have 6 pairs. And after an hour where they get to know each other musically, we shuffle them around so they get to meet other musicians. And in 3 hours, you would have met 3 new musicians, have become more acquainted with their instruments, with their musical traditions, with their personalities. So you develop these one-on-one connections, this intimacy that you need to make good music. Then we have workshops where each of them teach everybody else about the music that they bring to the gathering. So the Egyptians teach about their music, the Ethiopians, the Ugandans, the Kenyans. And what happens after all of them do these workshops, they all start realizing that they don't have the full answer. A person might be really strong in polyrhythms and another person might be really strong in improvisation. So how do you leverage the strength of everyone in the group to make something that none of you can make alone? Then we start with the creative process from trios. Every person picks 2 people to make a song, into quartets, into quintets. So you have, you know, trios, like 4 trios happening at the same time, 4 songs with different leaders, with different musical visions, different arrangements. And then when you switch to 4 new leaders, you have 4 new songs. So in 3 hours, you could have 12 songs with everyone being feeling like they're being the leader on some songs and supporting others on their own. And that setup allows an atmosphere of camaraderie. Everybody feels like they're on the same level and everyone feels like it's their music as much as it is everyone else. You're not playing on somebody else's band. You may be playing on somebody else's song, but at some point there's a musical roulette and you go on the front of the stage and they're supporting your vision. All of this for us, this creative process, this kitchen as we call it, is a metaphor for the way we could solve our water problems in the Nile Basin. So I'm happy to tell you more about that. But for us, the process is as important as the product itself.
That's incredible. Yeah, let's come back to the specific issues in the Nile River Basin area. Let's stick with the gatherings. You're speaking about the gatherings of the musicians. You have musicians from 11 different Nile Basin countries who come together with their different musical aesthetics and instrumentation. These are people of different ethnicities, languages, of course, musical stylings, different religions. You have Coptic Orthodox Church members of Ethiopia. You probably have, I would guess, Christian Rwandan or Ugandan Christians, perhaps. You have Muslims of Sudan, from Egypt, etc. So this is a rich blend of so many different traditions and backgrounds on offer. And so at the gatherings, the group comes together and, as you've mentioned, works on songs. And these songs turn into the Nile Project albums. I understand the musicians work together in these workshops at the gatherings. Beyond that, is there a connection with the local communities that takes place, and what exactly is happening there? What's the interaction between the Nile Project and the Nile Project musicians and sort of the educational component that spills out or is presented to the community?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the idea for the project is to have this music that we make through these gatherings become the inspiration for becoming more curious about your Nile neighbors, thinking about the Nile as a whole watershed, and thinking about the problems that we face in the different countries as interconnected, and coming up with solutions like the musical solutions we come up with that satisfy both the upstream and the downstream countries. What we have in the Nile, it's the longest river in the world, and we have about 450 million people. It's also one of the skinniest rivers in the world. It's about 13% of the water flow of the Amazon. So there is not that much water to go around in 11 of the poorest countries in the world that are struggling with many of their development goals. So the governments of these countries lack the capacity to develop a coordinated approach to find this cooperative solution alone. And what they need is the support of their civil society and their private sector and many other strata of society that could come up with these innovative solutions, with these entrepreneurial ideas that support their agenda. So what we're hoping to do with this music is engage citizens by allowing them to see how what they do, whatever they happen to be doing, if they're journalists, if they're musicians, if they are professional business people, how that fits within this big puzzle that is the water sustainability. So we're starting a couple of programs. We have a university program that we just launched this year. And the university program is a suite of activities for university students at 6 partner universities. We started in Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, and Egypt this year. We have student fellows that are coming from all these universities that will be establishing Nile Project chapters on their university campuses and working with local communities on developing quote-unquote Nile projects. And these projects are the way that they will engage with these local communities on addressing problems that are at the intersection of water and food. 80% of the water in the Nile is used for agriculture, so most of the water that we need and we're fighting over is really used to grow food and to allow for food security in these different countries. So if we can find some solutions that are student-led along the Nile Basin, that could help with taking off some of the pressure that we have around these water demands. We also have a collaborative network that is made up of policymakers, of university professors, and other leaders in different fields. We started this year with the university professors. So we have a Nile Scholars Network that are looking at collaborative research opportunities among the different universities.
So these are professors at these universities in Eastern Africa and North Africa. Yeah. Okay. So you've mentioned food sustainability, you've mentioned agricultural issues, the lack of capacity of the 11 governments there to effectively work together for the betterment of all. What are these the main areas, or what are the other sort of sustainability and anti-poverty work and cultural conflicts that are at play in this region of the Nile Basin?
Well, the basin is very big. So yeah, there are so many challenges. If we talk about just one of the countries in the Nile Basin. If you talk about Ethiopia or South Sudan or Sudan or Egypt, I mean, each of those countries could could take a whole program.
Sure.
But I think what we're trying to focus on is really the water conflict and how we can turn the water conflict into an opportunity for cooperation.
Can you tell us briefly about the Grand Renaissance Dam? This is the dam that you mentioned earlier, a project. I forget the year the project was initiated, but it was the issues played out amongst, Ethiopia and also Egypt?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So some background about the geography of the Nile would be helpful here. The Nile starts in two different tributaries. There is the Blue Nile that starts in Ethiopia, and it meets the White Nile that starts in Lake Victoria in Khartoum, in the capital of Sudan. And then they flow into Egypt, and then it empties in the Mediterranean. The Blue Nile, even though it's much shorter than the White Nile on a map, supplies 85% of the water to the main Nile that flows into Sudan and Egypt. And traditionally, Egypt and Sudan have taken most of the water coming from both of these tributaries, because we're talking about tropical countries upstream that have a lot of rain, hence the Nile, and very dry countries, Egypt and Sudan, that didn't have any of this water. So in 1929, the British rulers in both Egypt and Sudan made a Nile treaty that gave Egypt the lion's share of this water to protect the British agricultural systems that were in Egypt. And this treaty was revised in 1959, but many of the upstream countries were saying, how about us? We were never involved in this treaty.
You're speaking of Burundi, Ethiopia, these sorts of places? Or
All of the upstream countries. So Ethiopia, Eritrea, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania,
sure.
Rwanda, Burundi.
Okay.
And there has been a lot of push and pull about, you know, how do we figure out a solution to this? How do we allocate water equitably among the 11 countries without compromising the historical water rights of the downstream countries, Egypt and Sudan, who have grown their populations based on the water security they get from this, from the Nile. So it's a pretty complex problem that hasn't been easy to solve. And in the midst of these water negotiations that have been taking place, many of the upstream countries have wanted to develop their hydroelectric infrastructure, and building dams on the Nile would require that agreement in the first place. So you just have this chicken and egg. Can we build a dam before we agree on the water allocation, or do we need to first agree on the water allocation? And it has been further complicated because Ethiopia has proceeded to build a dam without the environmental impact assessments that are required by law, by international law, for the downstream countries. So the dam is almost fully built at this point, and there is still a lot of tension between Egypt and Ethiopia mainly, but also many of the upstream countries that are looking to follow suit with other hydroelectric projects. The Nile project, just to say, is not pro or against dams. We're not pro or against any country. We're a politically neutral platform that allows for all of these governments to speak if they'd like to, but we're not really the vehicle for government dialogue. We're the vehicle for citizen dialogue.
So at the performances that take place along the Nile, when the musicians gather and perform in the Nile Basin areas, what do you see as far as the coming together of different peoples, different backgrounds, different nations? What's that energy like at a performance?
Well, it's really hard to characterize. I mean, you have it's like a family of very different siblings, and you feel the familiarity, the friendship that exists among all the different musicians, even though they speak different languages, they look different, they play different instruments, and there are very different colors on stage. really kind of a moving palette that like changes from a song that seems to be, you know, very danceable tune to something very serious, to a song from Ethiopia, to so I think there is a lot of shifting with these very basic ingredients that you see on stage.
So of course, this is the African Sky podcast. Our lens sort of comes out of Mali. When I was sitting at a performance the other day in Athens, Georgia, a great, great show, a friend sitting next to me turned to me during a certain song, and he whispered that that the song struck him as like a North Desert blues, mm-hmm. a la Ali Farka Touré or that kind of style. And there certainly are some similarities. The sound of the flutes, you know, is reminiscent of the West African Fulani or Tuareg type flute. The call and response vocals is featured in multiple areas. The desert blues kind of grooves. You know, I turned to him and I whispered, "Hey, it's the same desert." You know, mm-hmm. But there are certain connections. Even on the Aswan album, I heard a sound, an instrument that sounded a lot like the soku, which is the one string horsehair fiddle of northern Mali. And so, as an ethnomusicologist, can you tell us about the similarities and the nuanced or the very distinct differences between East African and West African music, both the Northern Arabian and Arabic-influenced music and modalities, as well as maybe the differences between your sub-Saharan Mandé music of West Africa and the sub-Saharan music that you might hear in a Kenya or Tanzania. So essentially, and I would say Stephen Sogo mm-hmm. of Burundi, one of the musicians, fantastic musician in the collective, and he performs a number of instruments and sings. I mean, his singing really reminded me of a griot's performance. His singing specifically, probably more so than the others. It struck me in that way. So can you speak of this musical exchange between West Africa and the Nile lands?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question that you bring up, because actually our Sudanese singer Asia Madani is Fulani. She is from Mali. Her tribe moved from West Africa historically to Sudan. So I think when you dig a little deeper, you start realizing that, like we're talking about the connection of the north and the south of the Nile Basin, you start seeing that there are a lot of other connections happening between the east and the west of Africa. This piece that you're talking about is an example of these connections. There is a historical camel route between West Africa and Mali, you probably know, and Sudan, and many of these camels would go to Sudan, and then from there they would go up north in Egypt, and the largest camel market in Africa used to happen 10 minutes behind my house in Cairo, where all these camels were being brought from West Africa. We recently went to the port in Aswan and Lake Nasser, and we were talking to the marine authorities there, and they were telling us about the routing of all the freight that goes on the Nile into Sudan, and from there it goes on land into Chad and many other Central African countries. So there are lots of connections. There's a lot of, from far away, you look at Africa and you think West Africa, you know, Mali music, you know, Senegal music, and you have East Africa. But actually, Africa is full of connections in the middle that we haven't even started looking at.
Mina, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing and for the great work that you're doing. We're excited to follow along, and we welcome African Sky supporters, family, viewers, listeners, etc., to check out the Nile Project, nileproject.org, and to enjoy the fantastic music and collaboration.
Thank you very much for having me.
This episode was produced by me, Adam Klein, engineered by Ben Holst of Tune Welders, and edited by Seth Samuel.